appropriate we open up this hour with the Allman Brothers Band because my guest has a story about them. His name is Chuck Klosterman. He's an editor and writer for Spin Magazine and has a new book out called Killing Yourself to Live, which is essentially a sex, drugs, rock and roll story about a road trip he took across the USA with a specific goal in mind. And that goal in mind was to encounter as many of the places that rockers had died as he could. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. You say in the book, dying is the only thing that guarantees a rock star will have a legacy that stretches beyond temporary relevance. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, that's sort of a bombastic statement, I guess. There's other, you know, but what I'm basically taught, what the idea of this book really is sort of how I had made this decision in the summer of 2003. Me and my editor at Spin made this decision. She wanted me to do an epic story. I would do a really large story that would involve a lot of driving and going to places all over the country. And we had to find some kind of unifying principle. And the principle I found most interesting was to go to the actual locations where rock deaths occurred, like the actual point where, like, the Skynyrd plane crash hit the ground and the actual apartment where Bob Stinson drank himself to death and, like, the greenhouse where Kurt Cobain and shot himself.
The area where the road where Dwayne Allman had
exactly.
His motorcycle accident.
With the idea of of kind of investigating how music changes to the listener once they have the knowledge that the individual died early or died tragically, and how that sort of informs and kind of twists the iconography of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So what, you know, I mean, it's kind of cliche, but it's very true. It's like, you know, when a rock musician dies at a very early age and never really has a point in their career where they seem adult, really, or old, or somehow outside of the relevancy of the culture, that freezes their music in time and sort of changes how people actually hear what was there all along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We never get to see those people grow into middle-aged has-beens, is what you're saying.
Well, I mean, that would be a rough way of saying it, I guess. I mean, there's some truth in that. I mean, it's not always the case. I mean, I don't think anybody looks at Keith Richards and says, what an embarrassment. I mean, they just
No, but if Davy Jones had died young, the Monkees would be much more legendary than they are today.
Oh, well, not only would they be more legendary, but the meaning of that band would be different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you know, now they're sort of remembered basically for the media idea of someone trying to replicate the Beatles in America, you know?
Right.
The Monkees are almost sort of a metaphor for any kind of prefab rock band.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they had died, say, if there had been a Monkees plane crash,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think that the way people would remember the meaning of that art, of that group would be very, very different. And the question that I kind of try to pursue in this book is, why is that? I mean, why does death, specifically in rock and roll, have a very specific effect on our perception of sound? Because, you know, the Monkees records wouldn't be any different if they had died.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, Daydream Believer would sound exactly as it does.
Right.
You know?
And we mentioned the Allman Brothers there at the top. You did go to the place where not only Dwayne Allman, but what was the other guy's name? Butch Trucks? No. Barry Oakley?
Yeah, Barry Oakley.
Almost the exact same spot.
He is generally known as the other guy who died
right.
in the Allman Brothers. But
if your name's not Allman and you're in the Allman Brothers band and you die.
That was sort of one of the interesting ironies. After Dwayne Allman died, there only became one Allman Brother in the Allman Brothers band.
That's right.
So it was sort of wrongly pluralized. But,
and still plural to this day, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. And but what's interesting about that situation though is both those guys, both Oakley and Dwayne Allman, died in motorcycle accidents at essentially the same intersection within the span of, like, within a year of each other.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Barry Oakley was thinking, wow, this is where Dwayne died just before he died? I always wondered that.
You would have to assume, I mean, I guess he would have known that was the place. You know, I guess that would have been an interesting thing for me to wonder.
I mean,
I'm surprised I didn't think about that.
It only takes a microsecond to have a thought, so I wonder if in his last microsecond that irony struck him.
Well, but the Dwayne Allman case is a good example of what I try to do in this book, which is that, like, you know, when I was driving to Macon, Georgia, knowing I was going to go to this nexus, this road nexus where the accident happened, you know, I was listening to the Allman Brothers in the car stereo, and I was thinking sort of about the iconography of Southern rock and, you know, the meaning of how, you know, we, because of both Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Allman Brothers, we just kind of associate that these bands were young men living in semi-rural areas who basically lived short lives generally and lived their life under sort of the premise that it would be short. I was thinking of all these things, and I was listening to these songs, and then when I got there, it became very clear that it was just a road. It was just a road where, you know, where the cross section where two roads met.
Mm-hmm.
And that when it started to really dawn on me that all of this sort of relationship between celebrity and death and all of the meaning that we seem to connect or inject into the deaths of these people is a completely interior process. And that, you know, it's – I mean, I talk about this whenever people ask me questions about, like, you know, what did you learn from this? Well – I mean, there was no huge revelation. It's not like I went to where Buddy Holly died and I was suddenly like, oh, now I know what it means to be alive.
There was no moment.
But what I realized is that, you know, we're all – like, you know, we all know we're going to die. That's the one unifying element.
In everybody's life.
Everyone knows. But you can't live your life like that. You can't, you know, spend every – you know, they say live every day like it's your last. But if you did, you'd have to wake up, email all your friends, tell them you love them, call your parents, say thank you for putting me on Earth. You'd then quit your job and, like, stare at the clouds all day and, like, see – you know, you could – it'd be an implausible way to live.
Right.
So we compartmentalize this knowledge that we're going to die and put it kind of in a part – of our subconscious. But when a celebrity or somebody we like or a rock star dies, that's able to manifest itself through them. I mean, I think that part of the fascination people have with rock and its relationship to death is it's a way for people to kind of examine their own mortality through people that they feel emotionally connected to but have no tangible relationship with.
Mm-hmm. And that is coming to them through the music. So when you get to that crossroads where Duane Allman and Barry Oakley both died, what's there?
Well, you know, nothing marking it. I mean, you know, it's an insurance agency across the street. I think a pet clinic was across the street.
Do they sell auto insurance there? Motorcycle insurance? That would be incredibly distasteful.
Might have even a farm credit union now that I think of it.
These guys died on their motorcycle. Yeah. If you do, you'll want insurance from Bob Johnson.
But you know, you look, you know, you're saying what's there, and you really look for meaning or significance. You try to imagine what the accident would look like. You try to think like, well, okay, if you know, his motorcycle would have probably been in this lane. Would have been easy to get, you know. You start trying to reconstruct these things in your head, and you just find yourself asking, like, why am I doing? Like, what if I figure this out? Like, what if I can really pinpoint? That was the same way with like some of the plane crashes I went to, or like when I went to Cobain's house in Seattle, and you know he was killed in a greenhouse, but the greenhouse isn't there anymore. Now it's just plants.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one sunflower that's growing straight up that seems to either be inadvertently or consciously marking the spot of where he was found.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and kids were around, just, you know, tourists looking at it, and they're all looking at this sunflower trying to, like, you know, somehow see something about Kurt Cobain, to understand Kurt Cobain in a way through this plant, you know? And it's – I just think it's a real fascinating desire people have.
In all of the places you went to – except for Graceland, which stands alone, was there anything special marking any of the places that you went to visit?
Well, there was one in particular in West Warwick, Rhode Island, where the Great White Fire happened. That was certainly the most evocative place. It's for a couple of reasons. One, it had been more recent. That tragedy had happened within 6 months of my visit.
Mm.
For another, it wasn't one person dying. It was 100 people dying in a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, it wasn't celebrities. It was people that – you know, it was just average guys and women. And, you know, in a small community like West Warwick, Rhode Island, almost everybody in town had some kind of relationship. So what they've done there is some people just on their own have taken the floorboards from the station. That was the club that burned down during the Great White Show. And they've kind of created these little wooden crosses that are about 3 feet high, and they've made 100 of them for all the people who've died. And they've made a circle. They've put them in, you know, it's a circle of crosses throughout kind of the perimeter of the club. And then if people want to decorate each one for someone they know who died, they can. And then people just sit there in folding chairs in the middle of the night and smoke cigarettes and talk about these people they know who died, you know, and it seems like in Rhode Island everybody drives a Camaro IROC, so IROCs are always pulling up and guys are getting out and telling you about somebody that they talked to 2 nights before he died.
So you could literally go there any night, and there are people there.
Oh, I was just there, in the middle of the week,
just a random night.
Yeah, because I mean that was, but now I don't know if that's still the case now. I mean, granted, it will be 2 years since I did this
mm-hmm.
now, but at the time, yeah, it was like they were still like, you know. It was one of those situations where that community is now so defined by that accident that almost everybody was dealing with it. I mean, one of the people I met there was actually saying how strange it was in the weeks directly after that fire Because if you looked like you were sort of, you know, a hard rock guy, if you looked like a metal kid, if you were wearing a metal T-shirt, if you had long hair, if you looked like, you know, you might be the kind of person people would normally associate as a burnout, people were so nice to you. Because, I mean, the people who died, you know, Great White's relevancy as a band had been passed for 15 years.
Right.
You know, they were popular in 1988, really. Mm-hmm. And so the people going to that show were not going there to be cool or because it was like the thing to do. I mean, these were people, working class people, often in their late 30s and 40s, who really just wanted to have some connection to something that they liked a lot when they were young. I mean, it's, you can't say like, well, this tragedy is more than another. But to me, it was particularly sad that nobody died because they were trying to be cool. I mean, mm-hmm. there was somebody who was just living their life and in a real unironic, earnest sense, trying to experience something they cared about. And, I mean, I thought that was certainly the most moving place I went to.
It's the Paul Harris Show here on News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with Chuck Klosterman. His book is called Killing Yourself to Live. And you actually kind of came around the circle a little bit, maybe not all the way, but maybe 180 degrees, to another Great White event. Mm. On your road trip, what was it, up in Iowa?
Yeah, I was going through Iowa, going to where Buddy Holly's plane crash actually was, and I hear on the radio that Great White is doing a benefit show for victims of the station fires. So I just turned my car around, drove straight to it, and you know they were playing it at a venue to a crowd that was very similar to the people who had died in the fire. So it was sort of like, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, for journalistically, it was a very good accident to have.
Yeah, but it must have been eerie being in a room full of people who were alive, considering where you had just been, where almost the exact same people had been and had died that day.
Well, it wasn't too eerie, I guess. I mean, I think the people in the crowd were just looking at it as a show. What was stranger was talking to the band, who was sort of living this paradoxical existence where, on one hand, they're trying to just sort of do the one thing they can do, which would be professional musicians and get over this and sort of live a life that isn't completely tied to that accident. But yet they have to, you know, absolutely cannot escape it. I mean,
right.
You know, they're attempting to give, you know, dollars and charity toward the victims and there will never ever be a conversation any of them will ever have with any member of the media that isn't focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in this strange situation where, like, you know, as a musician, you want to do something that kind of puts an impact, you know, imprint on culture. And they did once, you know, in the late 80s because they were a successful band. But now their imprint is so much greater for this terrible reason. I mean, it's not a tragedy the way the fire was, but it's sort of their tragic figures in my mind. You know?
Yeah, and it's interesting. You talk about something hanging over a musician or a band's career for a long time. Ringo Starr recently has been out promoting his new CD, which is called Choose Love, and he's done virtually every TV talk show there is, and he goes on, and sometimes he talks, sometimes he doesn't, just plays that song. Mm-hmm. But a couple of times he's sat down and been interviewed, and every interview is a discussion at some point about the Beatles. Now, I realize you're in arguably the greatest rock band of all time, but they broke up 35 years ago, and Ringo has done other things. I would like to see just one question with somebody asking him, what were you thinking when you did the movie Caveman? Just, you know, ask him about anything else non-Beatle related. And I'm sure the guys in Great White wish the same thing.
Oh,
ask me about anything that doesn't involve West Warwick, Rhode
Island.
But,
you know, Ringo Starr is being a Beatle in terms of the history of rock is sort of like being, you know, Thomas Jefferson or Washington or something. I mean, like their significance is so vast. I mean, in regard, like, there's nothing, you know, like if John Lennon were still alive, you know, he had a, you know, Plastic Ono Band's like one of the greatest records of the 70s, but it would still be hard not to ask him about the Beatles.
Yes, but don't ask him the same questions. That's my problem with these Ringo interviews. So do you talk to Paul? You know, all that sort of stuff, and it's the same thing over and over again. And as a Beatle fan myself, lifelong Beatle fan, I just wish they'd move on to other things.
What I would ask Ringo is, if I said, like, do you talk to Paul, I would say, is it weird that you have a one-legged wife now? I think that's so interesting. It's like, Paul McCartney has married a pirate. You know? I mean, she's a really sexy pirate. She's really foxy, but, like, I just think it's so interesting. I mean, like, you know, you could be in the biggest rock band in the world, but, you know.
And you're one parrot on the shoulder short of being married to.
Yeah.
I gotcha. Chuck Klosterman, the book is called Killing Yourself to Live. He's an editor at Spin Magazine and here on the Paul Harris Show today on News Talk 1120 KMOX. '73 classic rock, more Allman Brothers. I believe that's the Brothers and Sisters album. Chuck Klosterman is here in the studio with me. He's a senior writer at Spin Magazine and has also written for Esquire and has a book out this week called Killing Yourself to Live. It is a mostly true story about his adventures traveling the country, visiting the spots where rockers died, thus guaranteeing themselves a legacy that perhaps they would not have had they lived. He will be signing copies of the book and doing a talk and a Q&A at Left Bank Books, one of the great bookstores in North America. It's in the Central West End on North Euclid, and he will be there at 7 o'clock tonight. How did you plan out your itinerary? How did you figure out where you were going to go, and where did you decide, I'm definitely not going there?
Well, you know, when the initial grain of the idea came up, it wasn't so tied to death. It was at first, it was just like, well, let's have you go to every interesting place in America that has a relationship to rock music, which we figured would take about 400 years. But we thought, well, okay, well, still, let's just, you know, let's get on the internet, let's read books, let's have the interns who share, let's just put a list together of all possible places, any place that seems interesting. But of course, that raises the question, you know, what qualifies as interesting? Like, you know, it's like where ZZ Top goes to the barber, is that interesting?
No.
You know, it's like where Rick Ocasek bought a car, is that interesting?
No.
You know, is Madonna's gynecologist, is that interesting? You know?
No.
So, well, some of them I think might have been. It's, I mean, it's all personal. But the thing I realized when we were putting this list together is the only places that always struck me as compelling were the places where these rock deaths had happened. So I decided that I would make the story just about that. Now, when I left, I did not intend to write a book. It was just going to be a piece for the magazine,
mm-hmm.
like a 5,000-word long-form kind of article. But I was writing every night because I had a laptop with me, and 4 or 5 days in, and suddenly dawned on me that I was going to have way more material than I could put into this story. So I made this decision that the piece in Spin Magazine would just be about the places where the deaths happened. It would just be the journalism. And then the rest of the book would be everything else, like mm-hmm. what I was thinking about and all these sort of meditations on death and relationships and things like that. I mean, in retrospect, if I'd known I was going to write a book, there's other places I would have liked to have gone. I mean, I wish I'd have went to Cincinnati where people died in the Who concert.
Riverfront Coliseum.
Yeah, I wish I would have went to Wisconsin where Otis Redding died. I wish I would have went to where Randy Rhoads died. You know, there's all these places that I would have preferred to have gone, but at the time it seemed like I was going to have too much information as it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Does it seem as you looked into rock deaths that the airplane is the most dangerous form of travel for rock and rollers?
Well, if you're a rock star and you don't die from a drug overdose, in all likelihood it was a plane crash. I mean, you know,
I mean, those people you just mentioned, Otis Redding, Buddy Holly, who you talked about earlier, Leonard Skinner.
Yeah. Well, because they're always, you know, they're flying in those small planes often because they don't have to fly commercially. And, you know, it's a risk. I mean, it was especially true, you know, I mean, I think it's less so now, but I mean, you know, the plane Buddy Holly was on, you know, I bet if we could see that kind of aircraft now, a lot of people wouldn't be, like, killing themselves to get on it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you go to places where rappers died, like Vegas, for Tupac Shakur?
Well, there again, I should have went to where Biggie Smalls was killed in L.A. and where Tupac Shakur died in Las Vegas, but I ultimately didn't. I mean, I had plans to go where, you know, Graham Parsons died in Joshua Tree, and I should have done that. I mean, like I said, I didn't realize I was writing a book. It's only, you know, the book sort of is, I mean, really is more of a memoir. Like, if someone is going to read this book because they really want to learn about rock deaths, all of them, mm-hmm. if they want a comprehensive encyclopedic consideration of this, my book's not the one to buy.
Right.
I mean, like, what my book really is really three elements. The element that I already talked about, these rock deaths that I happened to visit, my sort of coming to grips with these kind of three relationships with women in my life that were happening, sort of the memoir parts, and sort of this idea of, if we all always take the knowledge of death and put it in our subconscious, what would happen if for 3 weeks I was always conscious of it? In other words, if I thought about death all the time and listened basically to, you know, the 600 CDs I brought with me and just thought about, you know, the finite quality of being alive. So it's those three things. I mean, it really is probably, like you said, like a road book. I mean, that's the best way to describe it. You know,
all right, let's talk about the CDs for a second, mm-hmm. because I'm guessing as an editor at Spin, you get lots of free CDs. How
True.
Do you choose the for most people, this would be a gigantic collection, 600 CDs. For you, it was probably just a piece of a collection.
Well, you know, if I'd done this even a year later, I would have just brought my iPod. I had an iPod at the time, but I couldn't get the road trip thing to work, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like, well, I'll have to just do this conventionally. So I started picking the CDs I might want. I didn't know if I'd be gone 3 weeks or 4 weeks or what would it be, but I knew I'd be in a car for the majority of the time. So you start first just taking your favorite records. You know, you start taking the ones like, well, I'm going to want to listen to Appetite for Destruction. And I'm going to want to listen to Sticky Fingers. And I'm going to want to listen to, you know, My Bloody Valentine. I'm going to want to listen to Rumors. But then you get to this point where you're like, well, you know, though, I won't just want these sort of definitive records. Sometimes I might be in a mood to listen to, you know, hip-hop, but I don't know which hip-hop artist to take, so I'll take four of these records.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, well, if I have four, I may as well take 14 because, you know, and then you start thinking like, well, who knows what I'll like? You know, maybe I'll want to listen to, you know, one day I'll just want to listen to the Beatles exclusively. Well, then I better take the whole Beatles catalog, and that's all. I took them all, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe I'll want to listen to something that I normally don't even listen to in my house. You know, maybe I'll want to listen to the Cardigans' first record, you know? So I found myself just adding and adding and adding, and because I had a back seat with not much in it, I just kept filling it up, you know?
I was going to ask what kind of vehicle you were driving that you could have not only 600 CDs, but the stuff you need for a month-long road trip.
Well, I was in a Ford Taurus, and basically the CDs were in the back seat, and like my bags were in the trunk.
Uh-huh.
So I was when you're by yourself, you know, you got a lot of space in the car, and I ended up I brought 600 CDs with me,
yeah.
And I ended up still bought four on the way. Like, I ended up, like, you know, I was looking at these 600 discs and I couldn't find what I wanted to hear when I was in Bismarck.
Let me mention another place you talk about in the book, and that is the swamp where Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane crash happened. Ironically, at the same time that they had the Street Survivors album out with the flames coming off of them, which many people think is a collector's item, but
yeah.
It sold about 8 million copies, so that's the definition of not a collector's item, regardless of how many people asked John Marshall about it on this show, our record-collecting guru. But when you went there, is it really in a swamp? And again, what's there, and what do the people around there say about it?
Well, that was one of the harder ones to find, because which is somewhat paradoxical because it's one of the most clearly marked. I mean, when you actually get to the swamp, just prior to that, it's on a farm called the Moat Farm, this family of the Moats, M-O-T-E. And, like, they've made, like, a little – you know, there's, like, a Confederate flag there and a little freebird archway and an eagle and all this stuff. But, you know, people were just telling – you know, giving me road directions, and it's – I mean, it's rural there. Like, I mean, I almost hit a cow on the road. I mean, I'm not joking. It's that – I mean, I'm from rural North Dakota, and I'm saying this place seemed rural to me. there were, you know, and you get there, and it was one of the kids from the farm took, you know, led me on his four wheeler out there, you know, and it was getting dark, and then he was like, well, okay, you got to go about, you know, 50 more yards through these trees down to the swamp, and you'll find the actual place. But he's like, don't do it. And like, you know, why? And he's like, there's cottonmouth snakes there. Very dangerous. And he drove off. So it's getting very dark.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
How far are you from where your car was at this point when you say he drove off?
Oh, I'm next to my car.
Oh, he led me
in my car.
I thought you said
yes.
he took you there.
Yeah. So I figured, well, I gotta do this though. So I drive the car as close to as I can to the grove, you know, and I put the headlights on, I shine them in, you know, and I start walking in there. But like, you know, it's getting dark and it's hot, and like the ground seems alive, and I just am realizing I can't see anything, and I'm like, if I get bit by a snake, man, there's no one going to help me here.
Right.
So I got as close as I could, and then I realized, like, you know what? I'm just – like, I can see where I need to go, but, like, I can't get there. So it's like, this is as close as I'm going to come, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to actually, you know, find the propeller.
Right.
I'm going to just, you know, just – so I just kind of looked at it and just, you know, thought about Skynyrd and, you know, got back in my car and played Give Me Three Steps.
Oh, you did get back and listen to some Skynyrd?
Oh, yeah. I would often do that. You know, like, one of the interesting things with this road trip is, like, you know, I'd be driving through New Jersey and I'd listen to Born to Run, and I'd driving to the South listening to some of those Southern rock bands and, you know, listening to Replacements in Minneapolis and just sort of trying to – that's, you know, the connection between a sonic, the sonic quality of something and its geography, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a break and we'll come back with more with Chuck Klosterman. The book is called Killing Yourself to Live. He will be answering questions about this and talking about it and signing copies of the book that you can buy at Left Bank Books on North Euclid in the Central West End. That'll be tonight at 7 o'clock. This is the Paul Harris Show, a different kind of talk radio on News Talk 1120 KMOX. It's Paul Harris in the studio today with Chuck Klosterman, a senior editor at Spin Magazine. He's written for Esquire and has a new book out called Killing Yourself to Live. He'll be at Left Bank Books tonight signing copies of it. He says in the book, with the exception of Jim Morrison, Eric Clapton is the most overrated rock musician of all time. Please defend your statement.
Well, you know, it's not that Eric Clapton is a bad musician. I mean, he's a great guitar player. He's a workmanlike singer. But
no, but that's a long way from Eric Clapton
no,
is
but,
God.
But the key is overrated. Well, that's essentially why he's the most overrated. The Clapton is God. I mean, uh-huh. You know, it's like, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame keeps inducting him, you know, as a solo artist, as a member of Cream. I think they inducted him as a member of Traffic, and he wasn't even in the band.
Yardbirds, they got him in for that.
Yardbirds.
Blind Faith, probably.
Blind Faith won't make it. But, I kind of use that to get in because I love Derek and the Dominoes record. And I talk about Layla and sort of how it's interesting how the beautiful piano coda on that song was actually written by the drummer who was schizophrenic and ended up murdering his mother and going to jail for 16 years. And I was talking about how when I learned that information, it changed the way I heard that piano part. And I started thinking, like, maybe this is like what it sounds like in the mind of a schizophrenic, you know? And then I just sort of kind of worked through how that's a sort of predictable but sort of immature way of looking at things, or, you know? And there's a lot of interior monologue like that. And there's a lot of rock criticism in this book, but yeah, I'm a rock critic. So.
Yeah, and one of the things that you tell in the story is how you ended up in China Grove, the town that is actually not named after the classic Doobie Brothers song, or that the song is not named after, or reverse that.
I saw it was in North Carolina, and there's a sign for China Grove, and I was like, I gotta see if this is the city, right? So, you know, I'm trying to remember like the song lyrics, but all I can remember is the part that goes like, whoa, China Grove, you know? So I'm driving, I don't even know what I'm looking for, you know, like, what am I going to see,
yep.
You know? But then I find a guitar store, and I pull in, and I talk to the guy, and he's like, you would not believe how many people ask this question. Like, a guy came from Japan and asked that, but actually, it's a China Grove in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, say down around San Antonio
in
the song.
Yeah, he mentions that, yeah. I couldn't remember, obviously, if I had put those lyrics together in my head, but, you know, it was just one of those spur-of-the-moment things where you see a sign that says China Grove and you're like, well, I'm a rock journalist. I'm going to investigate, you know, and see if, you know, if I see a statue to Skunk Baxter or something on the side of the road.
There's probably a missile statue to Skunk Baxter now.
Yeah, yeah. Something like cutting taxes. You know, it's like
that's right. As you did this trip, you said you didn't have any great epiphanies in any of these places. But did you have one experience that just made you say, oh, man, am I glad I did this?
Well, you know, it's so weird. It's like that I had that experience, but it came from writing the book. Like it sort of not came from the experience of going to these places, but considering what it meant to my life, sort of, and how these ideas and how these places and these people I met and these things I did, you know, how that sort of became the framework and the soundtrack for this summer I spent. You know, I mean, it is interesting. Like I'm doing this promotional tour for this book. And this tour is 6 weeks. Well, my epic road trip was like 3 weeks.
Yes.
So it's sort of like the tour to promote it is bigger than the actual experience. It's sort of like how the TV show MASH lasted longer than the Korean War.
And interestingly, you are coming through a town that has a pretty good rock and roll history here in St. Louis, first time ever. So I'm thinking, since you're doing a 6 week tour now and going to all these different cities, including our town, sounds like volume two to me, Chuck.
Maybe I'll run into Nelly tonight. It'll give me something to do.
There you go. The book is called Killing Yourself to Live, in which one of the basic concepts, besides having a good time on the road, is that rock stars became much more famous in dying than in living in many, many cases. And it is a terrific read, and it is more than just a rock and roll road trip. There's a bunch of other stories and interesting relationships that Chuck has along the way, and I will leave it there because it's a PG-rated show. So thanks very much for coming in tonight. Have a good book signing tonight at Left Bank Books at 7 o'clock tonight in the Central West End. They're at 399 North Euclid. The book is Killing Yourself to Live. Chuck Klosterman here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.